which deprived Mr. Neal of his right to intelligently exercise his peremptory and causal challenges and violated Mr. Neal's right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. Second, it showed that Juror B was unqualified and incompetent to serve as a juror, which violated Mr. Neal's constitutional right to a jury of 12. And third, the court's failure to declare a mistrial and continued questioning of Juror B in violation of Crim P 31 and CRE 606B was coercive and violated Mr. Neal's right to a unanimous verdict. I would like to discuss all three of these problems if we have time, but I'll begin with the juror misconduct issue. Pursuant to statute, a juror shall be disqualified if he is unable, because of a mental disability, to render satisfactory jury service. Here, Juror B failed to disclose his mental disability even after the court instructed the jurors to be forthcoming with information, and after other jurors indicated similar mental disabilities and were excused sua sponte by the court. To evaluate this misconduct, this court should consider five factors: the juror's assurances that he was capable, the nature of the withheld information, whether the non-disclosure was deliberate, the prejudicial effect of the non-disclosure, and the practical remedies available to the court at the time that the non-disclosure came to light.
Counsel, even assuming that, you know, this juror should have disclosed that he had an undiagnosed, you know, situation, even assuming that he needed to disclose that, why wasn't any prospective harm from that failure to disclose effectively cured when the trial judge asked the juror about his work on the trial? He asked, you know, let's focus on your work as a juror in this trial. Were you able to understand the evidence as it was presented? He says yes. I mean, that's essentially all we expect from the jury. So why doesn't that address any concerns about the claim of misconduct?
For two reasons. Anything after the first question with the standard jury polling, any further questioning was coercive and in violation of Rule 31. Forcing a juror to explain his verdict in open court amounts to coercion. Many of the questions violated 606B and were the type of questions going to impeach the verdict that are not allowed. And his assurances at that point during the coercive questioning contradicted many of his other statements that he was incapable of providing satisfactory jury service.
To be clear, he never said he was incapable of rendering satisfactory jury service, right?
He said...
That's not what he said.
The court said... On page 34, when I first questioned all the jurors, I asked whether anyone had a physical or mental condition that would render them incapable of performing jury service. You didn't say you had such a problem. Is it your position that you don't have such a problem? And the juror said, well, apparently I do, if I'm supposed to see a neurologist about it. I didn't think my problem was as severe as some of the other people. But if you look at what the other jurors said at that time, there were three who indicated that they also had mental disabilities, and they were on the same medications that Juror B was, and were in the similar, they had similar circumstances as Juror B. And he chose at that time to not disclose that information, even though the court excused those jurors in front of the rest of the jury panel, which would have shown to Juror B that this was something that the parties and the court would have been interested, was interested in knowing. Juror B's assurances that he was capable of providing satisfactory jury service were unreliable, and the court's reliance upon those assurances was misplaced because of his contradictory statements in the record and the contradictory evidence. He couldn't remember his verdicts from just moments ago in the jury room when he was asked about them. He affirmatively agreed he had a mental disability rendering him incapable of performing jury service. He stated that the problem was deep-seated. He'd seen a doctor, a psychologist, and was just waiting until trial was over to schedule an appointment with a neurologist about his problems. He stated that he was on various medications, had nightmares, had suicidal thoughts, had sleeping issues, and memory problems. It's impossible to know how these problems affected his jury service. And the further questioning of Juror B was coercive, so his responses are suspect and his credibility unreliable in light of that coercive questioning. Juror B's, the nature of the withheld information in this case is very different from the nature of the withheld information in other cases addressing this issue. Many of those cases address when a juror during trial realizes that he is acquainted with a witness, that he just didn't recognize the name during voir dire. In those cases, the parties and the court can evaluate the relationship and evaluate what impact that relationship might have on their assessment of the evidence. Here, Juror B's mental disability goes to his ability to serve as a juror. It's impossible to evaluate, and unlike those other cases involving bias. And the harm is different. In those other cases, perhaps a cautionary instruction would instruct the juror to put aside what they know about the witness or their relationship. Here, the harm goes to Juror B's ability to provide satisfactory jury service and function as a competent juror. I believe that the record shows that this concealment was deliberate. At a minimum, it was a knowing concealment of the information. The court had instructed the jurors to be forthcoming with information. Other jurors were discussing similar problems. Those jurors were excused. Juror B knew he had these problems and was actively waiting for the trial to be over to schedule his appointment with his neurologist.
Counsel, as to the other people who were excused, didn't the juror say that having heard them say what their problems were, he didn't think his was as severe?
He did say that during the point of questioning, which became coercive. But compared to those other jurors, and this is on page 34 of the July 18th transcript, there are three. On page 34, Juror S says he has mental health problems. He's on Prozac, which Juror B also stated he was on, and another type of medicine. He gets confused. Juror M stated she had a nervous disorder, anxiety, and panic attacks, and that she was on Xanax. That was on page 35. And on page 37, Juror P says, I have trouble focusing. I remember about half of the charges that you just listed. And I'm on medicine, and I have trouble focusing and start wandering off. These problems were similar to Juror B's problems, or not as severe as Juror B's problems. So because the record shows at a minimum a knowing concealment, that also shows that he was incapable of rendering a fair and impartial verdict. The prejudice in this case, this affected Mr. Neal's right to exercise his peremptory and causal challenges. The defense counsel had already tried to challenge Juror B for cause on other grounds, which was denied. This would have provided her additional grounds on which to challenge him. Because it was a knowing concealment, it shows that Juror B was an unfair juror who served on the jury, and it violated his right to a jury of 12 because he was an incompetent juror who essentially didn't count, and Mr. Neal received a jury of 11. Finally, this court should consider the practical remedies available to the court at the time of the non-disclosure, and here, this kind of goes into the third issue about Crimpy 31. Normally, under most circumstances, the court should either, when he's faced with a juror who can't confirm that his verdicts conform to the signed verdicts, the court should either send the juror back for further deliberations or declare a mistrial. The court should not engage in any further questioning because further questioning becomes coercive. Here, it would have been inappropriate to send Juror B back for further deliberations because he was an incompetent juror. And at this point, after the jury had returned their verdicts, there was no alternate. The alternate had already been placed in the jury. The only available remedy was to declare a mistrial. The second issue involves Mr. Neal's right to a jury of 12 under the Colorado Constitution. Juror B admitted he was unable to perform satisfactory jury service. The record supports the conclusion that Juror B was objectively unfit to serve on the jury. Juror B simply didn't count. He was like having, it was like having someone on the jury who didn't understand English and couldn't effectively deliberate. Mr. Neal was deprived of his constitutional gavel.
Counsel, but didn't the foreperson testify contrary to that? I mean, you're saying that he didn't participate. The foreperson said, you know, yeah, he might not have been the most active juror, but he certainly made his, you know, his presence known.
In violation of 606B, the court considered that information, and this court should also not consider that information. But even if you do, we don't know what was going on in Juror B's mind or how he was able to recall or engage in discussion or grapple with the evaluation of the evidence because of his mental disability. Mr. Neal was deprived of his constitutional guarantee of a jury of 12, and this error amounts to structural error, which mandates reversal of Mr. Neal's convictions. Finally, and we've touched on this a bit, the court erred by failing to declare a mistrial and engaging in coercive questioning with Juror B. Under most circumstances, the court has two options, but here the court really only had one. That was to declare a mistrial, and forcing Juror B to explain his verdict in the presence of the other jurors was coercive. As soon as Juror B stated that he could not confirm that the signed verdicts reflected his verdicts, the court should have declared a mistrial. Instead, the court engaged in coercive questioning, and this questioning violated Mr. Neal's rights to a unanimous verdict.
In what way was the questioning coercive? He didn't ask leading questions. It was just open-ended questioning.
It's the manner or the place in which it occurs that is coercive. Okay. It's that it's in open court in front of the other jurors, and you're asking, and especially at this point, after when Juror B says kind of, it seems to me nonchalantly, oh, I can't answer your questions, but then everybody realizes when there's a bench conference that this is going to be a problem. And then the court begins to ask Juror B questions, and it's doing that in front of the courtroom and the other jurors that makes it coercive, and the case law supports that.
As I understand the record, the part of the questioning that you're talking about now was where the court had the verdict forms given to Juror B, and he was asked whether those verdict forms reflected his verdicts. But the other questioning, that all occurred in chambers, is that correct?
I would have to double check. Yes, that is correct. But taking him back in chambers, I think, is even more coercive. When you're sitting here in the judge's office, I would feel a little coerced. if I may please reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
25 seconds left for rebuttal, and we'll reserve them for you. Any response?
May it please the court, my name is Jay Fisher. I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. Regarding the issue of Juror B's service, there was no problem in this particular case for two reasons. First of all, under the very unique facts and circumstances of this case, there is a debatable issue of whether there was any misrepresentation by Juror B because he had no medical diagnosis showing any confirmed problem, which rendered him ineligible for jury service. Second, even if this information was not disclosed and this court would find such, it was inadvertent. And based upon this, the defendant cannot show that the prosecution benefited from Jury B's service or that the defendant was prejudiced by Juror B's service. As to the first part, the issue of whether there was any misrepresentation is debatable. Juror B did not have any confirmed medical diagnosis regarding his memory or any issues with that. He had an upcoming appointment with a neurologist, and this was based upon one examination that was conducted by two physicians that, at least according to Juror B's description, it was a rather simple test that he did not pass. They wanted to see him examined for it. It involved him being recited four pieces of fruit, and then asked later in that particular appointment with these physicians, can you recall those names? And he couldn't. In contrast, Juror B said, my memory is such that I do very well with complex problems involving multiple variables, multiple facets, and according to his description, the defendant's trial in this case fit those particular parameters perfectly. This was a 10-count indictment, involved two separate incidents, multiple witnesses, multiple pieces of evidence, and according to Juror B, he said, I do very well in these settings.
Counsel, absent some sort of mental health examination or some sort of physician opinion, how are we to judge this, you know, this juror's capabilities?
I think you have to go upon the record that's been established at the court and Juror B's representations. The appropriate test, which was announced in Russo, is that the trial court is afforded considerable discretion to accept or reject the prospective juror's statements with respect to his own state of mind and his attitude towards the serious responsibility of jury service. And based upon what Juror B told the trial court and presented to the judge, again, he knew that he could handle this particular trial. He knew that he could involve or that he could handle jury service, this particular matter, based upon all the variables that were in play here, the multiple counts, the two incidents, the multiple witnesses. This was within his parameters of capability. Regarding the issue of the peremptory and causal challenges, under the current test, this court would have to find first that the omission was in fact deliberate. We're not abandoning any argument saying that there was no misrepresentation here based upon the lack of medical diagnosis, but if this court were to conclude such, any misrepresentation in this particular case was completely inadvertent. As has already been made an argument before this court, Juror B said, look, I didn't think my problems were nearly as serious as what other people had already stated during voir dire. And at least according to what he said about his capabilities, he could handle service in a particular matter. If there was a misrepresentation, it has to be considered as inadvertent. Again, what we're dealing with here is opinions. Jurors' opinions about their own capabilities, about their own ability to serve, and their own particular medical and mental conditions. And as such, if he says, I think this is within my capability, again, it's an opinion. And if he says such, then his ability to serve should at least be affirmed by this particular court. Again, it's only if it's deemed deliberate that we get into the whole issue of peremptory and causal challenges. Regarding the issue of the 12 whether there was a jury of 12, again, ultimately, the trial court did the appropriate examination in this case. Once Juror B said that there was an issue regarding whether or not the verdicts were his, and the trial court presented him with the actual verdict forms and said, is this your verdict? And he says, yes, it's a 12th juror, and there's a jury of 12, and they have rendered their verdict, and as such, there was no error. Regarding any issues about 60B, or 606B, excuse me, and whether this court can consider it, there is an exception within 606B that says a trial court can make inquiries if it believes there is a mistaken transmission of the verdict. There was a point here, obviously, when Juror B said, I don't know if this was my verdict, that there was an issue that the trial court had to resolve. And the problem being that the trial court had to say, there may be a mistake here, and I need to get to the bottom of this.
But the exception in 606B doesn't allow inquiry into the actual deliberations. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Except for an issue of an accidental transmission of the verdict.
Right. So why isn't it a violation of 606B when, for example, the court asked the foreman about, well, how was juror B able to deliberate? And the foreman goes on to talk about how he dealt with particular counts and things like that. That seems to be getting into the deliberations.
Admittedly, it's getting into the deliberations, but again, it's only within the parameter of, was he a qualified juror? Did he render verdicts in the service and within his service? And is there a mistake on this verdict form? In other words, was he in fact a qualified juror who rendered votes and participated and was an active or was an appropriately seated juror and able to render the appropriate service to get to a verdict in this particular case? So within that, the trial court acted within its discretion. It should also be pointed out that there's an instance within the record itself on page 50 where the trial court knew its limits, where it actually cut off the question and said, look, we're getting into deliberations. I need to cut this off. So the court knew its limitations and, in fact, exercised its discretion. It only went as far as it needed to ascertain whether juror B was, in fact, a qualified juror who was able to provide appropriate service in this particular case.
It seems like the trial judge was trying to find a way, because I remember when the judge said, we don't want to get into the actual merits, by trying to determine whether this juror participated, not what the merits of the argument was, but whether he participated.
That's correct.
It's a fine line. Are there any cases to talk about this?
Not that I've been able to find, Your Honor, except for one that I cited in my brief, which was out of the state of Colorado and from New York, which extends the 606B accident exception a little bit, but that's the best that I was able to find. Mm-hmm. Again, we're dealing with a very unique case here. I mean, at least I'll say in my own part, I'll probably never see this issue again as long as I practice law. So again, the trial court should be afforded the maximum discretion when faced with this unique situation of how it handled it. And I think it went above and beyond what it had to do to ensure that the defendant had a fair trial in this case. And not only, it could have simply said, handed him the verdict forms and said, was this your verdict? Yes, it was. Fine, we're done. Instead, it went into chambers, it conducted an exhaustive investigation on its own part to determine whether in fact he provided appropriate service and was in fact qualified to sit on this particular jury. So I think the trial court in this instance went above and beyond.
Are there any cases with all the numbers of Americans on medication now, especially as people get older, they're on medication. Do we have any cases that talk about this kind of thing where a juror reveals, I have anxiety, I'm on Valium, I'm on this, I'm on that. Does that automatically mean they have to be off the jury?
Not that I'm aware of. Again, I think it depends on a case-by-case in fact, or the particular facts of a situation. And again, we're relying upon opinions here of jurors and their capabilities and what they're able to do within the context of providing appropriate jury service. There's two more points that I would like to discuss. First of all, is the issue of any prejudice about juror B serving. There was no prejudice in this case. The verdict forms indicate that juror B voted to acquit on a number of the charges against the defendant. Furthermore, there was even statements made during the trial court's investigation that juror B was arguing on the issue of intent for the defendant in one particular instance. So,
well, counsel, if the juror was incompetent to serve, we don't really get into a prejudice analysis because then there was no jury of 12, and that's just reversible regardless of any prejudice.
That would be correct, Your Honor. Again, I'm just trying to cover my bases here in the arguments presented to this court. The issue of whether the questioning was coercive, it just wasn't in this particular case. The issue of coercion is evaluated on a case-by-case basis. In this particular case, it was a simple question and answer scenario with juror B in the trial court. Was this your verdict? Yes. And it just went back and forth. If the trial court had provided some kind of editorial or prodding or something along that line, it would be a radically different analysis. That did not happen in this particular case. Thus, this court should or we request that this court not find any coercion regarding the questioning. And if this court has no further questions, we ask that you affirm the convictions below. Thank you.
Thank you. You ready for some fast talking?
Here we go. I would just like to correct the assertion that the standard is that it be a deliberate concealment. It can be a knowing concealment, and even if it is inadvertent, it can still result in reversible error where there is prejudice. Here there is prejudice because Mr. Neal was deprived of his right to a jury of 12, his right to exercise his challenges, and his right to a fair trial. Mr. Neal respectfully requests this court reverse his convictions and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate you answering our questions. The case stands submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. And we are in recess.